a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Here this afternoon. Welcome to everybody that's listening on the internet. This is operations in the Government Operations and Audit Committee meeting. I believe it's the third meeting we've had this year. We're going to start with the agenda here in just a minute. Just a reminder to the committee people and the people in the room, please shut off cell phones so we don't have a problem interrupting the people that are testifying when they get ready to testify. The people that are going to be testifying today, please sign in and make sure that your name is legible so the secretary, when making the notes, can get the correct spelling of the name and accordingly. Please. Secretary, call the roll at this time.
Senator Haverly. Senator Hunhoff.
Here.
Senator Hunstad.
Here.
Senator Peters.
Here.
Senator Tiedemann. Representative Carson.
Here.
Representative Dennert.
Here.
Representative Dryden.
Here.
Representative Junkie.
Here.
Representative Turbeville.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. First thing up on is to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Move
to
approve.
Second.
We got a move to approve in a second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. The first order of business coming up on the agenda today is the area vocational school. Deb Shepherd, President, do you have anything to hand out? Welcome.
We're on. Mark Wilson, Director of Curriculum, Career, and Technical Education with the Department of Education. And in front of you, we have passed around basically a statewide responses to the 2012 budget. And this has been kind of a joint effort of working together with the four Technical Institute presidents and coming up with, obviously, just like all the school districts across the state and universities, they look at their system at their local level and look at what cuts need to be made. And in front of you, we have basically six key areas of cuts that they, or restrictions that they had to work on. If you turn into the first page, you can see basically that we have broken it out to show you what the state funding was. Also, you can see the distribution formula that has been worked out between the four technical institutes. Also, I want to make note, if you go down on 2012, go down to Federal Perkins. Again, we know what's going on at the national level. Basically, the technical institutes, we've taken a 17.69% cut with the elimination of tech prep and also with reduced allocations based on the federal dollars. And you can see on due to these cuts, basically, we tried to do the best we could with being reasonable on the state tuition increase, and with facility needs, we did increase state facility fees to take care of that. And you can see that right across the board, we've put this spreadsheet together so you can see each one of the columns there in 2012. You can go down to on the left-hand column where it says factor difference in actual PSA. You can see that we did that's a 10% cut that was to the PSA, and then you can go right across the board in each column area and look at comparisons from previous years.
Okay. Yes,
thank
Senator.
You. I guess I'm not sure where we're going to go with all of this, but I guess each school had to make certain cuts. If you can walk us through what how it was impacted with each specific school, I think they made each different decisions.
Right, and I'm going to turn that over to each one of our presidents and let them speak on behalf of each one of their schools and what impacts were taken care of at their local technical institute. Okay.
Good afternoon. Deb Shepherd, Lake Area Technical Institute in Watertown. Senator Peters is right. Each technical institute was given some latitude to figure out what would be the best way to absorb this these funding cuts individually. Lake Area Tech is in a had the position of where we have been steadily growing. We have 7 years of progressive enrollment growth. So we had an interesting challenge. We knew we would be receiving less state aid, but yet we were growing and had more needs that had to be met. So we did do some cutbacks. We had 8 people retire. We did not replace 2 of those people. And we did freeze salaries, so there are no raises this year. And did shorten 2 instructor contracts slightly. We've continue the travel restrictions that have been in place for a couple years now, so the only travel being done is absolutely needed. Sometimes programs have to, in order to maintain national accreditation, they're required to go to the national conferences, that sort of thing. You have to keep doing that. Where in a technical institute, as all of you I think know, one of the unique things about us is we're so equipment intensive. We have at Lake Area Tech, for example, 130 students in diesel technology. They spend 2 hours a day in theory class and 4 hours a day in hands-on. Now, if you can imagine those students working in pairs of 2, they each need a project. And so you need a lot of equipment to keep something like that rolling. And one of the ways that we've handled some of the budget cuts, again, are restricting equipment purchases this year to what's absolutely required for either accreditation or curriculum changes, that sort of thing. And, you know, we understand the situation the state's in, and we're trying to do our part just like every other entity. One danger that happens, though, when you restrict equipment purchases year after year is you get out of date in terms of what the students need to know when they go out to work, and that's a real problem. Another area that we're particularly concerned about is our computer equipment. 75% of our computer equipment is over 4 years old. And you can limp along, but there's a point at which that's going to start to be a real issue for you. I mentioned the staffing cutbacks. We did reduce a couple group sizes, and we did drop a couple or suspend or shelf a couple under-enrolled options for this year. And then we did discontinue our truck driving training. That was through corporate education. So that's basically the changes we made in our internal budget to deal with the cutback from the state aid.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Are you seeing any pushback from anybody in the community or in your facility as far as how are they responding to the cuts that you've made in your facility?
We tried really hard to communicate. I mean, it wasn't hard to see this coming. And so even before the legislative session, we were talking about how things were looking and all the way through. So I don't think internally people were surprised. I think our strategic advisory boards and advisory boards know what we're up against. I think everybody's just concerned that hopefully, you know, we'll turn the corner and the funding will start to be restored. But no, I can't honestly say I am. Students are concerned with the tuition and fee increases, but again, enrollment so far looks good for fall. So, no, I can't honestly say that I'm seeing any. Staff are concerned. We did lose 2 staff because of salaries. They said, hey, I gotta go back to the private sector. And I've had several more communicate to me that if this continues, obviously they'll have to consider doing that as well. But I've reassured them that I think this, we will turn the corner. So I don't know if you can call that pushback, but.
Thank you. Just kind of going through now, you've in the past, depending on how you estimate the budgets, and I know it's kind of a give and take depending on what's going on in the community and what's needed in your communities, but when you look at your historical trends on enrollment, we've seen an increase and we've seen a decrease. And the way you budget, sometimes you haven't grown as much as you've budgeted and you've had to send back some of the money. Where do you see yourself next year? Do you think you're going to be hitting the target that was set through the appropriations process for the fiscal year 12, or do we anticipate a problem with the increased fees for students?
At Lake Area Tech, we're, like I say, we follow track enrollment every week, and we intend to be right on or ahead. So,
thank you. I see the three gentlemen threw you out to the wolves first.
Well,
you arrive last? Is that what you do? You draw straws?
First. I'm
or the
not
one
sure
that comes
how
in the
this
door
happened,
last?
They'll owe me, trust me.
My question is in the same light as Senator Peters, only it has to do with your enrollment prior to going into this budget year. Your enrollment was up prior going in. And I guess my question relates to how much money or the income you receive from that enrollment, and then when you had a increased tuition, is that correct? What type of a deficit did your particular school have after the increase of tuition and fees after the cut? In other words, there had to be a balancing act. You see where I'm going? There had to be a balancing act somewhere in there. And then if you could, a two-part question, so then I'll leave you alone. State again, how many FTE did you release due to the budget cuts?
Two full-time. But we've been growing, so I'm dealing with increased numbers. So if we were anticipating a stable enrollment, we probably would have had to look at more. But we're growing. We're adding two new programs, and things are happening. So we just looked real strategically at the retirement, and that's where we made those cuts. To go back to your question, I don't know that in the whole budget process I ever put a number on how much, because the way we do it at Lake Area Tech is the programs make their budget requests. We look at what we can anticipate for tuition revenue, federal revenue, which, again, as Mr. Wilson pointed out, is declining rapidly. That's just been dropping. I've been at Lake Area Tech a long time, and the federal revenue's just been declining rapidly now the last, I'd say, 5 years. And so we've already kind of been factoring that in. And then we knew approximately how much, based on the distribution formula, I could calculate how much less I thought we would be getting from peer. The amount that I calculated we would be getting less from the state was about $260,000. And then, since we flatlined travel, we flatlined salaries, we flatlined equipment, that was a deficit I was working with. If we were running a normal budget year where we would have given raises, we would be doing some more travel for training of staff, and we would be buying the equipment we are deferring, and then also some repair and maintenance. You know, a person can just guess what that number would be, but the number I worked with during the budget process was $260,000 less. Okay. And that's the target I aimed for.
Follow up. Oh, yeah. So with that $250,000 target, then was that a target you had prior to the budget cuts or after the budget cuts? And then what amount of that was made up by a tuition and fee increase?
We wait until after the session is done to finalize the budget. So I knew the number then. I could pretty much guess it. In terms of, and then we go to the State Board of Ed for the tuition increase. So it would have been more had I not factored in the tuition increase, but I already was factoring that in. We run 40,000 credits that went up $5 a credit. So wouldn't that be 200,000? Yeah. So there's your, that's the additional part. I knew that we would be getting that much additional tuition.
I lied. I'm not going to leave you alone. So you ended up with about a $50,000 deficit at the end of the day from the budget cut, then, if you include the...
If you flatline everything else, which isn't, you know, I think a person needs to know that that's not a real-world situation. You can't do that every year. But, yeah, I suppose you could look at it that way.
And I would agree with you. And I understand, too. I think you emphasized that there was a lot of areas such as equipment and things that were necessary for growth that you had to put to the back burner. But thank
we're
you.
Deferring, yeah.
Any other questions? Any other questions to come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, and I could ask the same question, and maybe the rest could respond as well. You work with a certain number of clients, which are people that are requiring training, and you're providing that training. Number one, do we have anyone here to speak from their point of view, and if not, is there some way that you could respond the kinds of information that you've learned from them about this cut and how it might affect our future?
I don't believe we have any business and industry people here today because the letter, I guess it didn't really invite us to do that. It wouldn't be hard to get people, you know, to respond. I'll let my colleagues address this as well. At least with the people on my advisory boards and the people we work with all the time, I think they understand the situation. So we really haven't asked them. We're just, our message to them is here's the card we've been dealt. What can you do to help us? And so we're asking them to step forward. Lake Area Tech has had a major gift campaign going on for a couple years. And so we've already been asking them for financial support. One of the things we've been trying to communicate is that we really need their help with hard, tangible, in-kind gifts. And several businesses are stepping forward with that. And we're just becoming more, I don't want to say clear in terms of what our needs are and more bold in terms of asking. I think most business people, again, know what the legislature had to do and understand. Everybody's just hopeful now that we'll have turned the corner and some of this can be restored. So they're concerned because they need what we're doing. What we do is produce graduates, and they're all queued up and ready. When you look at a system that did the kind of placement we did, Lake Erie Tech's placement rate for the 2010 graduates was 98%. There are people lined up and ready for the graduates, so they will be concerned if there's anything that disrupts that pipeline. But I think right now, the jury's out.
Madam President, on your total budget, how much of your total budget at Watertown comes from the state budget, general funds?
Boy, I'm doing this off the top of my head. I should have brought that. I think our new budget, see, we have a bunch of bonding money in there, so I'm having to backtrack here, but maybe 10%. I mean, Mark has the figures here in terms of, do you have it broken down by school on here, Mark?
Not on this one.
Oh, okay. Isn't it? 18 million, about 15%, you're thinking? I would think it would be similar at each school because it's distributed by enrollment. So how much?
I was going to say 35 to 40.
Okay, see, what's messing me up is the bonding money, though, because, you should listen to. But in my budget, it's all rolled in there, and I'm trying to mentally pull it out of my head. But
So you'd say around 35%?
35 to 40, depending upon the institute.
Right, but that's okay. My second question for you, Madam President, how is the fundraising? You said you entered into a campaign on raising dollars outside. How is that going?
It's been interesting. We did our feasibility study before the recession, and then right after we announced the major gifts campaign and started our work, the recession hit. And so we had to slow down. And I talked to another school that was on the same timeline we were, and the word they used was recalibrate. So I guess we recalibrated, and we tried to be respectful to what was going on. Now we're trying to wrap it up. So we're not going to reach our goal, but we've been able to develop some new relationships and cultivate some more in-kind gifts, and we've had some major gifts that we really appreciate.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask, and I'm going to follow up on Representative Carson's question earlier, I would ask that you all get the information to us about, we want actual dollar figures per school, state general fund portion going in as it applies to, you know, and not just percentages, but dollars with the percentages, if you could get that to our staff at some point.
So what you're
should
wanting.
Be easy enough to dig out. Yeah. I mean, we don't want, I don't want all the, if you're going to, I want to make sure that it's segregated so we don't have the bonding and everything else in there as well.
I believe it's 28%, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
But, Senator, what you're asking for is what's our budget and then what are the sources of the revenue?
Right.
Yeah. That's,
and we may add on to this as we go along with the meeting today, but that's, we'd like that information.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yes, I'm going to kind of piggyback on what Senator Haverly was talking about. On, in addition to knowing each individual school with the total column, I'd like to be able to tie that to our budget book if at all possible. I'm having a difficult time getting this sheet that was handed out to tie to the budget. And so I'm not sure how that would work. And I understand you guys budget with forward thinking on FTEs for students and money coming in, and it's all kind of a constant flow. But if you could somehow get the numbers that you prepare for us to tie to the budget book, that would be great. So then we have a frame of reference of the amount of money that appropriated to you and then broken out between the four schools along with the three or four different funding sources that you have. That would be great.
I hate to keep making this my show, but I mean, part of this is, and I should have made these preparatory comments earlier, much of the legislature didn't feel that they got an opportunity to hear the technical institutes due to the budget situation during the appropriations process, along with just general questions based on what was going on. And then after the budget cuts hit, of course, the papers had reams of information coming out about how it was affecting the technical institutes across the state. Well, some of those messages were coming out in a very negative way, if you will. And so that raised more questions as to what I had asked President Shepard about when you had a tuition increase versus and so I think it's, in all fairness, so you know, that's sort of the direction we're going with this, is we're trying to get some answers to some questions that came after session, along with the fact we haven't had an opportunity to see you all for a while. So that's sort of the brunt of our questioning.
Any other questions for the President? Thank you very much, ma'am.
Jeff Holcomb, Southeast Tech. I'm sending a handout around for you. What I did is I took the letter that Mr. Flannery sent to us and kind of organized it according to those three points that were on there. So the first three pages are just our enrollment data. We have fall enrollments, fall semester enrollments, spring semester enrollment, and these are headcount. And then the third sheet is FTE, and you'll see that 2010-11 isn't finished yet. We do it off of tuition collected, and we'll be calculating that at the end of this month, because this will be the end of the fiscal year, and that will be the whole tie-out for FTE. Then, and on the fourth sheet is our actual cuts. And what I did is I gave you a summary, an overview. This is what we also gave to our school board and our STI council for their review as we went through the budget process. The first one is wages. These are actual positions that were eliminated, and the cuts that were made in that. The second is the benefits that go with that. So those two correlate together. We cut $237,239 in salaries and positions, and that equated to $48,736 in benefits. There was an administrative position, a clerical position, a part-time clerical, a custodial, a specialist, an employee contract, and then four instructors in that cut. Yes.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the what's the total FTE amongst all that?
Eight.
Four.
that were faculty, and then four other.
Okay.
Administrative, clerical, custodian, and a specialist.
And those were all full-time then?
Correct.
Okay.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have the eight FTE that were cut.
Correct.
On top of that, were there salary or wage cuts in your other?
Yes. If you go to the bottom, negotiated agreements, we have six negotiated agreements with different bargaining groups, and then there's one non-bargaining group that's also in there. So there's seven groups total. And of those, there were six groups that took a 2.05% decrease, and then one group that is still pending because we went into negotiations. We are at impasse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, there's one group that's still in negotiation. Can you kind of give us a status and a timeline? Obviously, year end, the fiscal year's coming up. You're going to be starting a new fiscal year in a couple weeks.
Correct.
What's our timeline on getting the situation resolved?
We are working with the Department of Labor, and we have a reconciliation meeting scheduled for the 28th of July.
What can we, as the legislature, obviously, we're the ones that approved the budget, we're the ones that sent the money to you, and you have to deal with it.
Correct.
What is it that we can do to help you in the situation, to help you balance your budget?
In terms of the negotiated agreements, what we will, you know, we go to impasse and then we go to this reconciliation. We will discuss if there's any way we can come to something. I'm sure the negotiating group would like to see it at less of a cut or no cut, and that's really what their stand is. Our position is it's a 0.205% or 2.05% decrease, and that's then there will be fact finding. All the information that we have used in the negotiation will become part of the Department of Labor, and then they make a recommendation to us.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up,
go ahead.
Where's all the money going to come from the legal bills that's being done with this? I mean,
it's my understanding that they're split. We pay half, they pay half as part of the negotiated agreement.
Mr. Chair, another follow-up?
Go ahead.
Any chance we can recoup our costs because the other bargaining group won't play ball?
This is a good question. I need to read that agreement very carefully to understand. I don't know as there is. I think that's part of the agreement is that we would split the cost. So it's part of that contract or part of that agreement.
And then I'll open it up for other folks. How much are we talking about in legal bills? Have you put together an estimate on how much money we're talking about?
I don't know. I honestly do not. I mean, in terms of the Department of Labor will send us a bill, I'm certain, and I don't know what that dollar amount is.
Okay.
One second before Haverly and then Senator Hunhoff. Run back to those numbers. Six, you've got how many groups that are under
an agreement?
Right.
There are six that are under agreement. There's faculty. That's the one that's at impasse. Then we have the administrators are actually a bargaining unit. Specialists, and that's they run from IT people to various groups, librarians. They fall into that negotiated agreement. Then clerical, custodial managers. I think I got the six. Then we have what we call employee contract. That's somebody that doesn't fall into any of the other groups. And they tend to be specialized to post-secondary, like a registrar. There's specific things that only post-secondaries have, so they wouldn't fall into the K-12 world. All of these other bargaining units, other than our faculty, are part of the Sioux Falls School District K-12. So we're in the same clerical agreement, the same custodial agreement as the K-12. And then the only one that's separate for us is our faculty. Then the employee contracts are just those that don't fall into a bargaining agreement.
Well, one more. Out of the six groups, you have not you're still negotiating with two. Is that one?
Just one.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you might have said it already, President Holcomb, but what amount, that 2.05%, what does that equate to in dollars?
It'll vary. The total number is the $218,178 at the bottom.
Or just the faculty specific?
Nope, that's everybody. We figured the 2.05 in there, even though we haven't settled yet. That's in that number. Yeah.
If you were to break, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. If you were to break out the faculty,
right,
in that portion, maybe I'm not being clear.
Yeah, that's a very fair question. It's about $100,000. If they were not to take the cut, if we were at zero, that would be an additional $100,000 that I'd have to cut.
So that number is already, you already have it figured in based on. Because that was the cut you needed to make.
Basically, what we've calculated is about $50,000 per percent with the faculty. So for every percent that I don't cut, that's $50,000 more that I must come up with to meet that.
And one more follow-up,
Mr. Chair. Yes.
Do all the schools have faculty? You said your faculty is a separate bargaining unit.
Correct.
Do all the schools have a separate bargaining unit for faculty? I see one head shake.
I do.
You do, you don't, and you do. So three out of the four do.
Correct.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Senator Hanoff.
Thank you. What's the length of time on your contracts?
We have a 5-year contract on language. And then 1 year on the dollars, the salary itself. So every year we go in and renegotiate the dollar amount in the contract. But for the language in terms of benefits and grievance policies and so forth, that's only once every 5 years.
Just a follow-up?
Yes.
Has that been your pattern or your habit that you have yearly renewal or contract negotiations on the salary?
No. When I first started, I'm beginning my 8th year. So when I started, we were in a 5-year contract. That contract, the salary was actually adjusted according to the amount that the legislature gave to the institutes, and that percentage growth was that would be the percentage increase in their salary. What we found is that the appropriation has a lot of variation, and we said we'd rather negotiate that each year to keep it of a more steady increase or decrease, as the case may be, a little more controllable if we did it every year.
Go first. Representative.
Thank you. On the budget overview,
yeah,
I'm looking at the bottom line. $6 million reduction equates to about a 23%, and I'm missing something someplace.
If you look at the capital line, which is about four up, we had $3 million worth of bonding that was in last year's budget that is already expended and done, and that will equate to part of it. Then we did some pretty serious reductions in our capital as well to accommodate this budget.
Thank you.
Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I was paying pretty close attention, and I see heads nod. We said that three out of four of the schools have separate bargaining for the teachers. And I think I heard Ms. Shepherd say they did not make any cuts to staff, salary cuts.
Yeah, we froze
the salary. And you're talking about salary cuts.
Correct.
Can I assume that maybe, or the question, I'm not going to assume, I'm going to ask the question. Did the Sioux Falls K-12 school district make cuts to their salary staff?
Correct. Yes, they did.
So is that the reason they're falling in line with you?
All of the other bargaining units are part of, and they all took a 2.05% reduction. My idea is to keep it all consistent across all units so that I don't have part of my employees taking a cut and part of them not.
Okay. So then as the rest of the presidents come up, I guess I'd like them to bear that question in mind. You know, I'm assuming then that Ms. Shepherd or Watertown probably didn't make salary cuts to their teachers, and maybe that question, that is not true. Okay, so I stand to be corrected, but I wanted to get that straight because of the Sioux Falls being under that umbrella,
sure.
And I thought I knew that Sioux Falls made some cuts to their salary and staff.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Peters.
Thank you. The first question I have, and we've kind of started going through, we're on our second school. Both schools have included in the amount of their cut, the cap, the amount of the bonding numbers. Because, I mean, that's a pretty flexible number. It's going to be very changed consistently. It's always going to change, and it's always going to change big. Is there a way we can get, when we get the budget and numbers and all the cuts based on schools, take out the bonding number so we can see, I mean, you've got it laid out so we can tell.
Right.
But with Lake Erie Tech, we didn't get the detailed breakdown. If there's a way we can get the details without the bonding, just because it creates such a swing.
Certainly.
And, Mr. Chair, I do have one other question. I kind of want to go back to one of my questions with the legal fees. I mean, we're talking about a $100,000 cut total. I mean, that just seems we're talking if we appropriate $22-23, sometimes $24 million, and it's only 35% of your budget, and we're chewing on only $100,000 of a differential. It seems kind of immaterial, but it's still $100,000 plus legal fees. Is there a way, and I don't know what your contracts say, but is there a way we can recoup our legal costs in this, or are the contracts pretty dead set on us being able to get it? And is it possible that the Appropriations Committee meets Wednesday or Thursday? Thursday. Is there a way we can do letters of intent to say that, hey, you know, it's we as an Appropriations Committee, is there a way we can send a letter on your behalf to say, hey, we did the responsible thing. You're trying to do, you as running the facility are trying to do the responsible thing and pass the cuts. I mean, we all had to share the love,
yeah,
or the lack of love. You know, how is there a way we can help is what I'm trying to say to help us recoup some of those legal costs.
I'm honestly not sure. I would appreciate it. I think that's always good. But as far as when you work with these negotiated agreements, you've come to that conclusion as part of the bargaining process that you will pay those if it comes to an impasse. I guess being fairly new to labor negotiations, this is an area that I am in new ground. I'm learning something every day in this process. So I guess I don't know what to respond in terms of whether that would be helpful or if it, I do find it frustrating that we are adding expense to an already challenged budget. But I also know that that's my obligation according to that agreement.
Are there any other questions? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked President Shepherd on the did you have a target figure? She had one of 250,000, I think it was. And did you have a target figure? And then what did you make up in the tuition and fee increase on that? So what kind of deficit were you left with at the end of the day?
We were very concerned, so we are probably more conservative in our approach. We will receive somewhere between $6.5 and $7 million in our appropriation from the state. So we were very careful also in estimating the number of credit hours, because as you can see from our enrollment, we're a little down and level, so we wanted to make sure that we weren't over budgeting to our revenue. So we increased our amount about 7.5-8% in terms of tuition and fees. We were making up a difference just shy of $1 million in cuts to accommodate, and that is what we needed to do to make it happen.
Go ahead. Follow up then. I
So where did that leave you to make up $1 million? You figured you had to make up about $1 million in cuts, and then you increased, and tell me where I'm wrong, but then there's on a timeline, then you increased your tuition and fees by 7%. Where did that leave you at the end of the day?
Because we were reducing the number of credit hours.
No, I understand that, but monetarily, do you know where that left you at the end of the day? I mean, if you had $1 million and then you increased your fees and they made up $700,000, do you know where that left you?
When we got done with our cuts, we were balanced.
So you balanced out that $1 million of the cuts with the tuition and fee increase?
Right. Correct.
And I almost hate to ask this question then. If you were able to balance that out at zero with the tuition and fee increase, why would you make the cuts?
Oh, no. I mean, with the cuts and the increase, it came out to zero.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Senator?
No, I would be too, yes.
Senator Hunstead, did you have a question? Oh, okay. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for that. I was kind of interested in the same question. We just have been at a legislative conference that meets over several states in a province of Canada, and one of the things that we talked about again is having a qualified workforce if you're going to have economic development. And so the question I asked earlier still stands with Mitchell as well, and I was hoping for a little response to that. So
we certainly are, our industry partners are very aware of our budgetary constraints and our concerns, and they are concerned that they will have a qualified workforce. They are also challenged with lower budgets and so forth. So we've had extensive conversations with like our healthcare partners as they adjust to the new Medicaid reimbursement. They also are looking at cuts, and so we share the pain. But they also understand what we have to do to make it balance.
Mr. President, you have a foundation or a group that monetarily raises dollars and cents for you. How has that been in the last year?
It has been challenging. One of our big partners in our foundation is financial services, the credit card industry, and they're struggling. So what I say is they haven't cut us. They just haven't made that step forward in faith, as my good pastor would say. And that's the challenge, is that it isn't that they aren't supporting us. It's that they can't support us any further. And that limits what we can do, too.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, could I just take a little time to explain this? Because I think there's a little bit of clarification that needs to be done.
Go ahead, sir.
If you look at fiscal year 2012, and if you look at fiscal year 2011, 2011 has estimate on there. And the reason that is, if you go down, the legislature has appropriated $21,911,820, okay? That it has been set simply because the FY 2010 actual tuition has been collected, and that's the number of FTEs that it shows there, right, at 5,985, okay? That $1,650,000 that goes to bonding, that goes directly to the debt service. That does not go to the Technical Institute. None of those, that funding goes to the Technical Institute. So really that part of the state budget is complete. But if you go down to where it shows state tuition and it has FY11, but you look at our FTE count, we're at 6,200 students. That's where we're estimating that by the end of this year, We are saying that we're going to be roughly at 6,200 students. That's why when you go back up to the top of the page on FY 2012, in the estimate of 6,200 students, that's why that is like that. Is everybody following that? Okay. Because what happens is during this year, we actually, the technical institutes get paid on the previous year FTEs. So what happens is you educate, let's say in 2011, at the end of June, when all the numbers come in on tuition collected, we're hoping that there's 6,200 FTEs that are counted for. And let's say we hit the bullseye and we're at 6,200 FTEs that we knew that the tuition was collected for. That's what the estimate we gave the legislature come 20 at the last session. That's why it goes up over to the 2012 budget.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Go ahead, Senator.
I think part of the confusion is we've got these fun little handy-dandy little budget books.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is our summary of what we did all of last session, and it's a nice little shortcut for us to look at. The problem is the numbers that you have here are integrated. We've got what's been budgeted for fiscal year 2011.
Yep.
And if you look at fiscal year 2010, it includes the bill when we overestimated FTEs, and you're backtracking. And then in 2011, you're looking at what happened for fiscal year 2011, but you're also adding on what happened in 2010. So the numbers are not jiving with the numbers in the appropriations process. And half this group here are appropriators. The other half are not familiar with the process at all or how you jive the numbers. And so is there a way we can do something similar to this but have your overs and unders from your FTE, your additions or your subtractions, so we can tie the numbers to the appropriations process? I mean, is there a way we can do that?
That's what I did in 20. If you look at the 2011 budget, we estimated for 5,761, and our actual number on tuition collected was 5,985 students.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I understand that.
Okay.
The problem we can't even get the big numbers to tie. I mean, the top number. And because we've got back in and back out, and I don't know if it's, I understand you've got the amendment here, but for some reason the numbers are not jiving, and I'm not sure. I mean, I've tied this all down myself, and I've talked to you on the phone, but it took, how long did it take us to walk through this on the phone? And you and I look at these types of numbers on a daily basis, and so is there a way to simplify it?
Working on that one. That is a work in progress.
On this particular sheet, then, if I look at FY 2011, are all those, what numbers are estimates? Obviously the total FTE. Am I missing a key somewhere? The
only thing that is an estimate is if you go down to where it says state tuition and state fees. We have an estimate number of 6,200 students that we think were educated this school year.
That would be the only, well, then
you're... That's the only one. That's the only thing that's estimated when it comes to collection on state fees and tuition. Because, see, then what happens is in 2011 at that bottom there, if we get 6,100, then what happens is then we have to go back up in 2012 and say and change it, and we have to say, you know what, we only educated 6,100 students and we were budgeted for 6,200. So in other words, those 100 students, that PSA at $3,046.82 would be reverted back to the general fund.
Mr. Chair? Or the glass could be half full and you could have 6,300.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to be. I wish I had that crystal ball. So,
go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So am I, if I'm following you right, are you using the 6,200 times the PSA to come up with the $20,540,000?
Yes. That's what the governor and you folks approved.
Thank you. And
that's right.
Could I ask Senator Peters, how much difference is that figure than from in our book? The the little...
Actually, if you go back into... You can't tie it to the summary book. You have to go into the detail book. And the number that you'll tie to your appropriations number is the line number 2, the legislative number. If you look at your fiscal year 2011 estimated column, line 2, legislator, you've got the $21,153,499 number. Mm-hmm. That will be what's in your appropriations book.
Mm-hmm.
Senate bill or House bill, whatever it was, 50, whatever the adjustment was to the previous fiscal year, yeah, to the adjustment to the fiscal year 11 budget, was an additional $758,000. And that is due to the increase in FTEs. If you go down to state formula category, you've got your estimated FTEs and your actual FTEs. Yep. We budgeted in the fiscal year 2010 budget FTEs of 5761, which is what made up our $21,153,000 number. They had an actual FTE count of 5,985 students. So it was an increase. That's where the $758,000 additional dollars came from. Mm-hmm. But do you see how confusing it is? Because we're dealing with fiscal year 10 budget to actual and adjusting, and we're backfilling, basically. We're running on a backfill, or if they've overestimated, then we suck it out.
If I might. The reason I asked the question, in the end, I just kind of asked the question, what's a different figure from the $20,540,000 that he's putting up there compared to what we appropriated for 2012?
We won't know.
We won't know that till 3 weeks, 4 weeks from now?
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
So we don't know if it's going to be short, long, because the count that comes in. But what's in the book, though, today, do we know that? What would that be, that difference? What's in the book for 2012?
What's
we had to pick a number.
Sure. The number that's in our initial 2012 budget is the $20,540,000.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Based on an estimate of 6,300 FTE students. So if they come in at 6,000 FTE students, we suck out times $3,000.
Thank you.
It was estimated on 6,200 students.
Yeah, it's estimated at 62.
Right.
Representative Dryden.
Thank you. I was just going to point out on page 30 of the summary book, about halfway down, there's that $20,540,284, which ties to the first number on this.
Yeah, so there's really no difference.
But, Mr. Chair, if I might, it gets confusing when you have two different years and you don't always have all of the pieces to step it out in order to tie it down. And if you don't have three books with you, it's hard to follow through at all.
But it really doesn't make any difference.
Mr. Chair, that's why I tried to put it on one sheet. So that's why we tried to put this spreadsheet very similar, the same way that we present the budget to the State Board of Education. And so that we're trying to build consistency so that we can, you can go back on the last page of this document, not to dig up old history, but remember the years of the one-time funding and the program development one-time funding. So I tried to put that into a block group so that everybody could see kind of where the dollars were at and show a history.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Greg Von Wall, President of Mitchell Technical Institute. One of the things that Lake Erie wanted me to mention to you, Deb Shepherd wanted me to mention to you, that there was actually 3 FTE cuts instead of 2. She had missed one of the staff cuts, I believe. What we did is we had about $250,000 in state aid cuts from what it was last year. Okay, that isn't including, we had a 47% increase in student population over 2 years. And so, you know, you can't, that running forward part is hard for us to describe and what we did. But what we did is try to make up that $250,000 state appropriations cut. We reduced program enrollment in 2 of my largest programs, Powerline and in electrical construction and maintenance, and we forced two early retirements in those programs. We capped enrollment in all of our other programs. We deferred hiring of four staff, two instructors, and two support staff. Restricted all travel except they're required by the state or for maintaining certifications or accreditation. We froze all capital purchases except if there was a safety issue with something, then we replaced that. Or if there was something that was mission critical, you couldn't instruct without it, then we'd replace that. Otherwise, we had no capital purchases planned. We have no capital purchases planned. No raises for the faculty or staff. And that's this is the second of the two out of the last 3 years where that's happened. And we reduced the capacity and the financial support for our Child Development Center. And I think, Senator Haverly, that's maybe what you're talking about in the papers. And it was dramatic headlines. I can remember that. I can remember that because I was in Rapid City at the time and I saw that and I made a condolence call to my contemporary over there. But one of the things that I think we're most concerned about is we're concerned about the wage freezes, that we're losing competitiveness. I don't compete for instructors with my peers. I compete for my instructors with the industry. And we are falling further and further behind in our wage scale with industry. And a good example of we lost a propane and natural gas guy. He doubled his salary by going to work for Montana Dakota Utility. I can't pay, and I have had just a bugger of a time trying to find somebody to replace him. I've gone to a headhunter now. They're sending me people from Florida and Georgia, North Carolina. Those guys don't stick, I'm sorry, when they come to South Dakota. So it may be possible that if I can't find anybody, I need to shut that program down. And so that is one of the great concerns that we have. And of course, you don't have to be very astute to figure out that natural gas is just burgeoning throughout the United States as an alternative source of energy for coal. And just at the time when this is happening, the demand is going up. That's why they're paying their workers more. And meanwhile, we're stuck in our pay scale. So that is a significant problem for us. The other thing that I think is a problem for most all of us is that we have a dramatically increasing student-teacher ratio. And you can say, well, so what? Well, we don't do, you know, these large 200-person classes like they can do for history or psychology or whatever the case may be. We're teaching technical training. A lot of it is very dangerous. Propane and natural gas, for one, we're now to the point where we have over the last 3 years, a 31% increase in the number of students per teacher. And so that dramatically impacts safety. It dramatically impacts quality of education you do for technical education. And I think pretty much across the board, we've had that same thing happen to us. That's kind of how we're absorbing these without dramatic cuts. And, you know, how do you put a dollar figure on that, or how do you put a dramatic impact on it? You don't until something happens. And then all of a sudden you say, well, we shouldn't have ever had that. We're pretty conscious of it, but let me tell you, when you're in that gray line, you're making a judgment call, whether it's safe or whether it's not safe there. And I can tell you that all of us are on that gray line right now, making that judgment call. So those are some of the things that we deal with that maybe not smack you between the running lights when you look at the budget numbers, because it isn't dramatic like an FTE cut, but it is dramatic when you look at the overall picture.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of, we're talking about salaries and competitiveness. There's the four institutes, and you guys complete an annual report that talks about some of these salaries and benefits and things. Can you give us an overview, or have you looked at that report? Where or do you sit in comparison to the other three institutes? And do you know, can you rank kind of big picture average salaries for each of the institutes? And maybe Mark is the proper person.
Go ahead, IPEDS.
Okay.
Yeah, IPEDS is how you do that, which is a federal database that we put in there. And generally speaking, I think the way that it kind of stacks up is Sioux Falls has the highest wage scale. Mitchell and Watertown are about the same. And then Rapid City, Western Dakota, is on the bottom end of the on the pay scale. But one thing, it's hard to say, let me qualify what that is, because I got power linemen that are out there earning $90,000 in industry, right? And, you know, I'm sitting there at $42,000 to $45,000 trying to make sure that they stay with me. Whereas I have general education instructors that are in the $30,000, $35,000 range. I've got a wind turbine technician that's in the $50,000 plus range, and he's only got 1 or 2 years there with me. So it all depends on the trade that we bring them in on, what their scale is to a certain degree. But once they're in, because of the bargaining groups, you have a difficult time adjusting these things unless you raise all boats. And I think that that's where most of us get stuck.
Mr. Chairson,
go ahead.
Do you happen to know what the numbers are? How much higher is Sioux Falls compared to the other three institutes?
I don't know.
10,000, isn't it? Roughly 10,000.
Okay. So that's just salary. That doesn't include the benefits.
I think that's a package. Salary.
Just salary. So Sioux Falls is about, on average for each salary, about $10,000 higher. Does not include benefits. Okay.
Mr. President, with that $10,000 salary, would there be a difference in the benefit package from Mitchell to Sioux Falls?
We may all have a little bit difference, but it pretty much washes out in the end.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Just to follow up on your question, you guys probably track what the state gets for benefits and packages. How does the technical institutes, or maybe even Sioux Falls being a little bit higher, kind of rate where you're at in comparison to the state benefits?
Well, we do a lot more work, so we should get...
I was going to apply for a job.
Senator Peters, it's very difficult to do that because I said, like, we have tradespeople there that we're dealing with a lot for faculty, and on the whole, you have more administrative. So it may be closer to say, okay, how does the administrative staff stack up against the state administrative staff? And I guess in that way, we're pretty close. You know, I think that if I was to take a vice presidential salary, I got three different levels of vice presidential salary. Mark is a little bit behind on some and a little bit ahead on others. So, you know.
Sir, you said earlier that you had a 31% increase in student-to-teacher ratio. Could you put a real number to that?
We went from, yes, I can. Just a minute, sir. We went from 15-1 ratio to 21-1 ratio.
Thank you. Go ahead.
One other thing that one of the questions was about what percentage, and it was like 35%. Realistically, what it is it's at roughly 28-27% of the Technical Institute's budget that they get from the state. I wanted to clarify that. Roughly around the 27%. We'll know that, too, when everything kind of gets hammered out by the end of the year, fiscal year. And we'll have that ready for in our annual report.
Representative Dryden.
When you talked about the $10,000 higher in Sioux Falls, I assume you're talking like positions.
Well, that's the...
Industries, it's...
Yeah, that's
you can't
it
compare
is,
one industry to another.
That's the problem, right? Is that you? We're not. But you, Sioux Falls has a much heavier medical contingent than we do. So we have much heavier in the electronics communications area than they do. So you can't really do an apples to apples comparison. Overall, maybe when you put them all together, you can get a feeling for that. But and that's what has happened.
Maybe general education to general education, or like industry to like industry.
I think
you've got the same programs.
Yeah, right.
But just a 10,000 doesn't mean anything.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
If you look at this sheet again, if you go down to where it says state and distribution formula, you notice that we have a baseline, then we have a weighted per student, and then we have a high cost, low density, high cost programs and standard. What we have done is you notice that that's really been, it started last year. Really what we're really trying to do is these programs, as Mr. Von Wald and like, for example, others in the high cost medical, what we're trying to do is set those programs up so that if you have like a high cost, low density, you get a little bit better distribution formula for those types of programs because they cost more to operate. For an example, if you have a computer course versus a power line technology program, we all know that the computer course is a lot cheaper to operate and run versus having a power line program. So that's why we've set up this distribution formula that way. And we're going to keep going this route for a few more years to see how it works.
Senator Donoff.
Thank you. I have a few questions, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
In the beginning, you said that you looked at your programs. Did you say you discontinued some programs?
No, we dropped the numbers that we would take in them.
Okay, you said you capped. How many students did you turn away then?
Turned 20 Powerline students away and about the same number of electrical construction maintenance.
Do you have a process in place to review programs if you're going to continue them
yes,
or not?
We do.
And what do you have to have for enrollment in a program to continue it?
We it's over a 3-year period. Let's say that it's a 75% number. So whatever it fills to 20 or fill on it is 20, you'd be 75% of that or 15 would be what the ratio would be. Now, if we fall below that for 3 years in a row, for the first year, you get put on a kind of a notice deal, and you've got 3 years to bring it back up. If you don't bring it back up, then you're subject to going in front of the Board of Education and getting it cut.
One last question, if I could. Are there programs that are duplicated on the campuses?
There are some duplicated because in some cases there are, for instance, a business in just about every community, you need bookkeepers, and it's a localized type of economy. And medical assists are kind of the same way. Most of us have a medical assist program. We have, for instance, there are other ones that are more on the technical area, HVAC programs. Sioux Falls has one, and we have one, but they're not duplicated in the other two. Most of we're very conscious of that, not doing that unless we all agree that there is a demand that can't be filled.
Mr.
Wilson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to Senator Unhoff? One of the questions was about continuing programs. One of the things that I think we take great pride in is that, bottom line, if our kids, when they graduate, or adults, when they graduate and there's no jobs, we will discontinue the program. Fact of the matter is we look at enrollment, retention, and placement. And from our office and from the Department of Ed and State Board of Ed, that's the number one thing we really look at is placement. And I think by changing those rules, that's why our technical institutes are ranked as high as they are across the nation for graduation and completion rate.
Representative Dennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I maybe wasn't paying close enough attention when you went down your list of cuts of faculty. Did you have a final number? Did you give me a final number?
I had, Representative Dennett, I had two FTEs that I cut.
Just two, okay, final number. If I could, Mr. Chairman, when you talked about the 20 students in a couple of different programs that you didn't take in or let come in, did they come into your facility and take other courses, or were they totally lost to this system?
So this is next year, right?
This is,
So what we did is we just dropped the numbers that we would take into the program. I dropped two instructors in each one in each of those programs, and basically we're not. So we got a waiting list, and notoriously on waiting lists, people will drift away. you know, if you don't let them in the program, they'll go someplace
else. So your knowledge, you don't know if they changed a major thought or something and enrolled.
We try to do that.
To follow
you know,
up.
We try to do that. If, for instance, Powerline, we'll try and convince them that they should go into a wind or into a electrical construction maintenance. Unfortunately, this year, both of those programs we cut. So, but I, you know, if somebody's interested in Powerline, you're not going to get him in business. I can tell you that. So, I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. So,
thank you.
Any other questions for President Van Walt, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I waited. I didn't catch the cuts at the beginning. You might have, if you could just define them out real quick, what you had to cut program and FTE-wise.
Dollars.
And, yeah, dollars-wise.
So we cut two FTEs.
And they were both?
Forced retirements is what we did, right? And we reduced the program, both of those programs, so we didn't need another instructor in them.
Yeah, do you have a dollar amount on that?
How much those were? One was a $60,000 level. The other one was a $45,000 level plus benefits.
Okay, and then the same question I asked is, I'm getting a picture of that. The same question I asked the other two presidents. You were third out of the chute, so you should have this all figured out by now. Did you have a target figure as well for your school, and then what did the increase in tuition and fees make up the difference, and what was the deficit?
So there's $250,000 basically is what the delta was. Now, that was the delta over last year, not the delta over what it would have been with the increase in students. And that's where I think, you know, we're maybe getting ourselves wrapped around the axle. We're getting ourselves wrapped around the axle here because you're cutting away from a number that it wasn't there, right? And so that's where a lot of these cuts have to bring. You have to cut something that wasn't there to bring it down to get to the 250,000. Then you make another cut. So that's what we did. So there's right there is probably 100,000 in personnel costs. There's another, and we froze salary. You know, I don't know. It's about a $50,000 cut per percentage for MTI when it comes to a percentage increase in salary. And then, you know, deferred hiring of forced staff. And this goes back to, is that a cut, right? Because you didn't you didn't have anybody that you cut, but it contributes to that student-teacher ratio problem. And so when you don't hire somebody, it's almost as bad as cutting somebody that you already had, except you're not affecting a person. So that's how that comes down.
And if I could make a comment, Mr. Chair, there's no doubt that, I mean, and it's just as frustrating for us at this end to try and go through this exercise every couple of years to re-educate ourselves on how you do business and how we have to look at the numbers, as has been pointed out several times, and someday maybe we'll actually get it to a point where we can both understand each other, and that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess you listed out your cuts, but the only true cuts that I've heard are the two forced retirements to add up to about 105,000 plus benefits approximately. And you said your hole was 250,000. What made up the rest of it?
No, my hole is bigger than 250,000, Senator. 250,000 over last year's budget. I had a huge increase in people and students. Right, so, you know, if you were going to take the PSA and run it up there, it was greater than $250,000. My cut was $250,000 over last year. Okay, so, so all of these cuts were actually over a higher dollar figure. So, these cuts are real cuts. A freeze on salaries are a real cut when it comes to.
I'm sorry. I don't want to know about the freeze on salaries. I don't want to know that, because if you look at last year. And you're going to go steady course. I understand you're going to have increased students and increased cost. I understand that. But I want to know what out of your base was taken out. You took two FTEs out of your base, right?
For people, yep.
Okay. What else was taken out of your base? I mean, did you cut office supplies? Did you cut
Well, sure we did all
daycare
that.
Daycare costs? I mean,
that's what I said.
What else?
We cut daycare costs.
How much?
$38,000.
Okay. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for the detail out. I understand it's tough, but... And I understand you've got increased students and your costs are always going to go increasing. I'm just trying to dwell down to, okay, we cut two FTE or we had two forced retirements. It
froze all capital purchases. Normally we would have about $150,000 in capital purchases.
Now, does that come out of your bonding or does that come out of your actual general budget?
No, that comes out of our actual operating budget.
Okay. So you have $150,000 of capital outlay and you had $30,000 of daycare?
$38,000.
$38,000 of daycare. And then the salary of
$110,000.
Okay. Any other pieces out there aside from all of the increasing? And I mean, obviously, students will always grow, but
travel costs. I mean, you know, I don't know what our travel costs is right off the bat was, but you know.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah. One question leads to another. What was your tuition fee increase?
It was about half of that. $250,000 cut is what it was.
What is it? You know what percent? And now I'm going to jump back to percentage. You know what percentage that was for Mitchell? About 5%.
Yeah, we increased tuition 5.96 or 5.6.
Right. Tell me where I'm going wrong, and Mark, you may want to answer this, but when you have a increase in attendance and you have a tuition, I mean, your increase in enrollment is one thing, and let's say that happens before anything else, and then you have an increase in, and I understand the years that and how complicated it is with paid tuition, but, and then you have a tuition and fee increase, shouldn't that be more revenue and not less?
Mr. Chair and Senator Haverly, one of the key issues is that what happens is they start building their budget also from that previous year. But if you would look at the dollar amount, let's say $338, already, the state of South Dakota, we're one of the highest in charging tuition for two-year institutions. Okay, so we want to take that into consideration, and as we work with the four presidents, but to make up that gap, we would have really have had to majorly increase our tuition even more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, and I understand. Without the political statement, and I understand what you're saying, because, I mean, in my duties on MEC, I look at all the different fees and tuitions for not only higher ed, but also two-year institutions.
Right.
And I understand that we follow at a very high rate here.
Yeah.
My question is more in if you have an increase, if you increase your fees and tuition and fees, and then you have an increase in enrollment, shouldn't that... When it all comes out at the end of the funnel, shouldn't it be an increase in revenue?
Senator, we would like to say that would happen, but you just you just can't raise it enough to make up that difference. And as Mr. Von Wald was speaking to, after a while, it'd be great where you could really make up that difference is let's say you had a cap of 50 students in a classroom. But when you have a cap of, like, let's say 15 or 18 in those high-tech programs, then all of a sudden the cost effectiveness isn't there because you need that additional amount to do that.
Okay. And just Representative Dryden.
Thank you. I think, Senator Haverly, the other factor, yes, as your enrollment goes up and your tuition goes up, it's more money, but then the state PSA went down. So that's the third factor in there trying to figure out how much additional revenue they got. You have to look at both years, those three factors for both years.
Right. And I'm not, and I understand, I'm just not taking, I'm looking at just the fact that when you have an increase in, I mean, if you just jot it down on paper, if you have 6,000 students 1 year and X amount in tuition, you know what the bottom line is. If you have 6,500 the next year, and you have an increase in fees and tuition, there's going to be more money. Now, I understand, I didn't take away the negative end of that about the state monies and the per student allocation coming out of there. But I what I was getting to with each question that I asked for each technical school president at this point is you had a target figure. you knew what that target figure was. Regardless of what year you were looking at, you knew where you were going to be. You knew what your enrollment figure was from the previous year, so you knew what money you were getting for the current year. So when you tried to adjust to that target figure, if you had an increase in tuition and fees, I would assume that you all sat down either with your school boards or whatever and said, here's what we need to make to get to that target figure. Does that make any sense? I mean, you said that you had to get rid of an employee. You had to not take capital. You were figuring out a way to get to that $250,000 target figure. And then you said, and we'll make up the rest of it with a 5.5% increase or whatever, you know, the case may be. Well, I think one of them was 7%. So my point is that if you continue to track year after year and you don't lose any more money from the PSA, if you stay at that tuition rate, you will see more of an increase at some point.
So there's one thing, Senator, that, you know, we said we cut two FTE because we did cut those two FTE. But in order to, for instance, you increase your population, you have general education courses that you need to teach, right? So you're hiring adjunct faculty, you're hiring extra teachers to handle those FTEs along the way as well. So it isn't a quid pro quo, everything is static and make the cut. It's a moving scale up and down. When the number of students go up, you basically got to keep it. And we've been trying to keep it into that 15-16 area, and we're out of that now. But there's only so far you can stretch in that FTE. And that's what tells you more accurately the impact of the budget cuts.
Mr. President, had the opportunity to drive out by your new institution that's being built, a very attractive-looking building, and one thing or another, when do you plan on being moved into it? And are we going to see an increase in staffing when we move to that building?
The building we're supposed to take, what they call, it's substantially completed, right, on the 24th, which means that we can get on the inside, but the outside is not going to be done. It will no increase in staffing in that building at all. We're moving it all over from the school that's across from the high school to the one out there in the south of the interstate. So,
is it possible you're going to have an office with a window when you move out there?
I do. I will have an office with a window.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Craig Bailey, president of Western Dakota Tech. I believe you're about 50% confused. Let me finish the job. That was a good strategy. Let me just start by answering a couple questions that have been already asked earlier. Our exact target number was $365,945, and we are starting to get some plaque from industry, the community, particularly some of the elected officials out in western South Dakota. Senator Adelstein has ripped me a new one more than once each year that we raise tuition. So, targeted number of FTEs reduced in the 11-12 budget year compared to the 10-11 at Western Dakota Tech is 20. 20 employees that will not be returning next year. Of those 20 employees, 4 were management. 10, including one manager, was part of the daycare center. One time we had a daycare program, child care program. We received tuition from that, also some other state aids over the years. Those monies have disappeared. The daycare center lost money every year that I've been there. I'm completing my third year in this position. About $100,000 projected loss. So those 10 employees of the child care center were let go. There was some publicity about that, of course. We've tried to take a very objective approach with the press. We don't write the headlines. When it says daycare devastation, and my nickname is Dr. Devastation, I am the face of you. I am the face of the governor when talking about how we're going to live in the future with the dollars that we have. This was not mission critical. Let me just take a moment now that you've got this process sheet there in front of you. Really, that's just an email. Your other listeners may not hear that unless we read it. But what you have there is an email from me to everybody at Western Dakota Tech, a few other CCs down at Rhapsody Area School District. And what we talked about was the principles by which we used to determine how we were going to create a balanced budget. Right? There was never an option at Western Dakota Tech to do anything but to create a balanced budget. So that 10% reduction equaling $365,945, that's a real number. That's 10% of our state aid from the year prior. Now, we have a lot of ups and downs going in here, and as I go through this, you'll see how hard it can be to net this. In addition to that, I inherited an organization that some may have felt was top-heavy in some areas. There's been significant changes. I will contend that those have been upgrades in staffing decisions. We have reduced a number of officers within the organization. We've had a number of turnover. We've added people in addition to cutting people. So whether we took two steps forward and one back or one step forward and two back, I guess each person could make that decision themselves. But we're spending money while we're cutting money. And some of the examples of where we added expenses are we purchased $775,000 of land from Rhapsody Area School District. Cuts right through the middle, 38.66 acres of Western Dakota Tech's 85 acres was owned by Rapid City School District. Right? We came up with a 10-year 0% loan to pay that land purchase off. That increased $77,500 to our annual expense budget. We also are implementing a Genzibar student information management system. Very, very important for the school to get out of the 1960s, be able to have some good data and information by which we make decisions to run this institution. That's a $50,000 a year for 5 years. Again, another 0% loan that we were very fortunate to negotiate. So we've done the things that we need to move forward. And as you'll notice in that email that I handed you about the budget process update, the principles that we used to guide our efforts were to meet that 10% reduction, to create a balanced budget that did not require us to go into fund balance. That was key. Make sure that all revenue generating areas, entities, at least break even. Right? There could be no profit centers that lose money. Right? As a principle of running the business. Right? I believe that was very important. Next was to keep all academic programs. Our mission is to train the workforce. I think anyone would be hard-pressed than to find a better bang for the buck in state dollars than what the tech institutes are doing right now. Right? Western Dakota Tech has a 94% job placement rate for the last year. 86 or 87% stayed in South Dakota. Right? This is really important. This is the driver in economic development. And we all know that. We all know that that's very critical. Pretty much every benchmark of the tech institutes are at, well, this might not sound right, are at a high watermark. given the normal use of that term, that might not make sense right now. Meaning that other than our budgets, everything else is really going great, as it should be, what we want it to be. And we measure that very specifically. Mark mentioned the four things the State Board of Ed legally charges us to do. And that's in our FTE enrollments, our retention, our graduation, and job placement. Western Dakota Tech on May 14th had the largest graduating class in Western South Dakota for the first time ever. 450 students walked across the stage. That's a 33% increase from a year ago. Right, 120 more students graduated, not just showed up, graduated, 450. Larger than Black Hills State and larger than South Dakota School of Mines. For the first time ever, Western Dakota Tech was the big dog of the graduating classes in Western South Dakota. So the other things that we wanted to do as principals were minimizing the impact on students. You could say that's maybe a little subjective when we increased tuition and fees, but we did want to do that at a minimum, and we really felt that we did that as a statewide system. And the other, probably the most important part of this principle was for us to meet our mission, to train that workforce, right? No matter what's going to happen with the state budget, we have people, employers, industry that need to hire employees. Our job is to produce those employees. That's our mission, very specifically, train the workforce. So we, as outlined in this budget process update, we included everybody with budgeting responsibility, and we've done that the last 3 years that I've been part of putting together a budget at Western Dakota Tech. There are about 40 people that have some type of budgeting responsibility, and they all were part of the process. And I'm very proud, actually, of the way that people step forward. One example for us would be our faculty members. We have 4 negotiated agreements at Western Dakota Tech: faculty, classified staff, administrators, and custodians. And each year, I've been very forthright with them to talk about where we believe the budget was going to be at. People have been very understanding of that. Our faculty wanted a 3% increase this year. They came to me prior to negotiations and said, we've changed our mind. We're going to go with a 0%. We support what you're doing here, and we're not even going to ask for that. So all of our 4 negotiated agreements ended up at 0%. So we are very happy to have a group that worked with us. Yes, we do have a large disparity in wages between Western South Dakota and Eastern South Dakota. I guess some would say that's the price that we pay to live in the beautiful Black Hills. But we do compete beyond just the Black Hills, and we compete beyond beyond South Dakota. My mission personally is to raise every employee at Western Dakota Tech's salary as much as I can over time, because it is inequity between the other parts of the state, for sure. And we compete outside of the state. We compete with industry, right? Our medical faculty could make more money working at Rapid City Regional, or even more yet, to move to East River. So that's always a very delicate dance that we have to play with all of our employees. And that includes the president of the organization. I'll just speak for myself that I'm very happy with the income that I earn, but it would take a 45% raise for me to be at the level that the last couple of people that sat in this chair was at. Right? And that's worth it, because I get to live in Rapid City, right? And that is a pretty special place to be. So that's always going to be a challenge for us, is to do right to our employees, to our citizens, and yet be able to balance this within the dollars that we have to work with. Right? We're not going to do this on the backs of students, nor is it fair to do it on the backs of employees. But together we'll balance that. Some of the other things that we're looking at, because we don't know what our cuts are going to be next year, is looking at RFPs, requests for proposals to outsource areas of the organization that would not, again, affect our mission or the other principles that I mentioned earlier. So over this next year, we're going to look at our food service. We're going to look at custodians, that we know that there are schools such as the School of Mines that have put those two together in RFPs and have reduced their expense budgets because of that. So those are some of the things that we're looking at already for the next year, in addition to potentially increasing student and fee rates. Mark mentioned that last year we were the 5th most expensive state in the United States to go get a 2-year degree at. The 5th most expensive. We may be the 2nd or 3rd. I don't know what we are. I'm guessing other states have increased their costs also, but we were 5th. We were number 1 in the United States in 3-year completers at 2-year programs. and that was the tech institutes. That's where your completers of two-year programs are coming from, and those numbers, I'm sure, are available to you now. So we understand how important this is, and we have really worked hard to do diligence in the process. So I wanted to share with you the process because nobody really had talked about that. A lot of time went into this, a lot of people, a lot of good people's efforts, and in it, just like everybody else, we've cut travel, we've cut our office supplies, we've cut training, we've cut pretty much everything that we can cut. I think that we're already to the point where there's going to be risk associated with continued cuts. There are some things we can't cut. Accreditation type activities, whether that's with the Higher Learning Commission or the Board of Nursing, et cetera. We have to meet all of the defined requirements of every authorizing agency that governs the tech institutes in some manner. And there are many, many government agencies and other authorizing agencies that have an impact on us that we must meet all of those defined requirements. So let's go through the other cuts here then that we did at Western Dakota Tech. So 9 employees and 1 manager out of the child care center. I think 3 of those were full-time. The others were benefited 32-hour employees, I believe. Other things are happening. We're looking at a 27% increase that we will carry on the school side for health insurance increases on our upcoming budget year. 27%. And other things, gas, fuels, the price of all of our supplies, they're all going up. So that was 10 employees right there. We cut 2 administrative positions, eliminated 1 classified, only 1 instructor, and then there were 4 non-rehires in open vacancies. 1 was classified, another was an instructor that retired, 1 custodial, and another manager, department chair. So that makes a total of 20 employees. Oh, 2 tech prep we also cut. That's 1 full-time and 1 three-quarter time employee that were part of the tech prep dollars at Western Dakota Tech. So the total number of names of people not at Western Dakota Tech, effective July 1st, 20. That's more than the other 3 combined. I looked at this as an opportunity. An opportunity for us to define what is it that we do within the school and how can we do it smarter? How can we do more with less? Not knowing what the future is going to be. And that's why it was so important that we involved everybody in the process. Some of you may know I come from the for-profit world. Involving employees in your processes is very key to reducing expenses, to finding solutions to problems. Typically, those people close to the problem are the ones that also have the solutions. And creating a culture that will allow that type of communication and teamwork is really critical, particularly when you're going through year after year of budget cuts. I don't know how much longer we could continue to make this level of budget cuts. Personally, I'm not interested in doing it again. My whoever follows me may be, but there's only so much you can do with nothing. Right? You can do more with less, and we will. And we will stretch that organization in every way we can in the state's citizens' best interest. A short little story here that I'll tell you. When I started at Western Dakota Tech, in my office, there was really only one thing. It was a 2-foot ruler. It's really a nice old antique Stanley wooden ruler with bronze edged. It was hanging on a tack on the wall. And I know a couple of you have already heard this story, but I asked what is this thing doing in my office, and nobody really knew. So I took that with me on my very first moment on the job. I had to go to an all-staff meeting on August 18, 2008, and for the first time meet 125 employees, which about 16.5% of are not going to be there on July 1st. And I said to the group that I was going to use this ruler for only one thing. I was going to use it to measure what was in our students' best interest. And I've had to pull it out once in a while when we talk about, different groups talk about who's more important and who should get money for this piece of equipment or that one or hiring a new employee or whatever it is. And it's a great analogy I've found for us to use that in each one of these decisions to look at what's mission critical. Is this essential for us to do our job right now to train the workforce? If not, can we put it off? So things like equipment, it'd be embarrassing for me to show some of the things that we do. Matter of fact, we don't show some of what we do when we're marketing our programs to some of our high school students that come by the busloads. It would just be too awkward to show some things. We have a lot of good equipment that we will make do with. One example would be a machinist program. Sioux Falls just cut their machinist program due to lack of demand. Luckily, in western South Dakota, for the gun manufacturers and some of the other Caterpillar and some other things that are starting to have some growth in manufacturing-type businesses, we have more demand. And we're looking at increasing what we're doing with our machinist program. But we'll do it with no new equipment. These are all conventional milling machines and lathe, conventional machine tools. We have a couple of pieces of CNC equipment that are not built in this century that we will continue to use. We just don't have a couple hundred thousand dollars to go buy a new CNC piece of equipment. That absolutely would not be on the list. Right? We're trying to save jobs, save what we can. So those are the 20 jobs that we've eliminated. We have also added some things. I mentioned a couple things with the land payment and Genzibar. We have a new building that we just are breaking ground on. We're just in the construction of the parking lot process. We hope that will be open in the fall of 2012. There's $500,000 worth of outfitting this building that is not being paid for by bonding that we will have to come up with in some way. Our foundation is not having a very good time trying to raise money. As a matter of fact, it's a very depressing time. Everybody else is also trying to get their charitable organizations to raise money. So we're all asking the same group. We don't have a lot of big businesses in deep pockets in western South Dakota. We're all out there asking the same group for that same dollar. And we have to have a pretty good story to compete with the others because there's a lot of good charities in western South Dakota. And so that is a challenge for us. Somehow in the next year, I have to come up with another $500,000 or we're going to have a new library that's not going to have chairs in it. I'm going to go to Shopko and buy beanbag chairs if that's what it takes. But we'll open that library. It'll be a beautiful building. Building will last 100 years. The things inside, we'll buy them as we can afford them. But we want to put all of our money in that capital project into bricks. That's what's in our best interest. All right, and we'll come up with, my desk will be reused in whatever office that I'm in. And every employee of Western Dakota Tech agreed ahead of time that they would all take that same approach. So, you know, we've cut a lot. And maybe this is a good time to sit for questions. I'm sure I must have stirred up a few.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm glad you hit those numbers right away at the beginning because I didn't get them all right when you started, so then somebody had to give me the – or you went through them again with the FTE. You said how many from the daycare did you cut?
Was there were 10 total
nine employees and one management out of there?
Correct.
Those were general fund dollars?
Well, yes. They're all expense dollars, so you would say, yes, they're general fund dollars. They're a profit center that did not make a profit.
What was the loss on the I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, follow-up. What was the loss on the child care and I'm not pointing this at you because I am very familiar with the kind of loss they were talking about even prior to your time as president. But what was the loss on an annual basis?
Well, it was about $150,000 when I started. We got it down under $100,000, but we never got it below $50,000 loss.
So $150,000 a year or $100,000 right in there.
Rounded to $100,000 for us.
And now that center's closed, correct?
It will be effective July 1st. Okay. It's wrapping up operations right now.
How much of that was that $365,945 target? Was that something that was after you cut the child care? In other words, was it an add-on to make the 365, or was that a number that you had targeted prior to closing the child care?
The targeted number was 365,945. That was 10% of our state funding. That's where I got that number from.
Okay, but I could take that $150,000 off that $365,945 since it's being affiliated with the state cut.
Closer to $100,000, but yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think, you know, and I'm going to have to go back and do some history lessons on myself and the questions I've asked in previous years about the child care center. It was never designed to be paid for by the taxpayers of the state of South Dakota. And unfortunately, even when I served on the Rapid City School Board, that question was brought up multiple times by me. And then when I got up here, I continued to ask that question. Somehow, it evolved into state general fund dollars going into that child care center. And Mark is waiting for an opportunity. And you know, it's disheartening to think that that got relayed into the cuts by the governor's proposed budget and then ended up hurting people because we were using dollars in an area that shouldn't have been used to begin with. And Mark, go ahead. Give me a comment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Haverly, sometimes when you start a new position, you do inherit whatever it is was there prior. What was interesting, if you go to the last page of this budget sheet, you notice down, I got to go down to where it says state distribution formula. And if you go over to the second line down where it says baseline common operations, but if you go to 2008, 2007, 2006, and 2005, where it says in their set asides. Does everybody see where that? When I first came into this position, they would take whatever the state legislature appropriated, you would subtract out what was due to a bond. You know, at that time, I think it was $824,000 for a bond payment. Then what would happen is, again, please understand, legislatures, that this is something we've inherited. But then what would happen is they'd say, okay, we're going to set aside $200,000 for daycare. And that was actually in one of the rules at one time. And so then what happens is you would divide that $200,000 by four and everybody would get $50,000. Well, bottom line, it still came out of the overall pot of the dollars. And then what happened was, as you know, things got tougher, it came to the point where Dr. Bailey made a comment where he sometimes is embarrassed to show folks some of his labs. I was kind of itching to make a comment back to that right away. If I could roll back the clock 3 years or 4 years ago, that was an interesting time too, because I remember when the struggle was we need to build and get some things cleaned up. Well, what happened was the state engineer and I had an opportunity to go around to all the campuses. And that was, again, we just live in the times that we are in. But even then, some of the presidents, I did not even have, they took us completely through the campuses. I can remember going to Mitchell Tech and going through a complete walkthrough. And as I'm walking up through, it reminded me of an old farmhouse that we grew up in, where you were going down to your basement, it was like a ladder. But it was had a little bit better of a slope than a normal ladder, but that's the way it was. And I asked Mr. Von Wald, I said, did you know that this is the type of facilities you were inheriting before you signed your contract? And I think everybody knew his answer was no. And the same situation has happened out at, I remember when the Rushmore building, the roof blew off. And I remember that, what type of the situations that has caused. And so what happened is, after I had some time to sit down and work with the state engineer and talk things through, and through some leadership changes, we came up with a really good, I believe, a strong facility plan. And we just had to make some tough decisions and move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you gave me time to let my jaws untighten. And I'm not going to dwell on this. I would hope that in the future we're a little more careful in setting up programs, because in actuality, you get rid of a program because it's non-profitable. It's costing the school money. That's why you get rid of it. You shut down programs. We've had testimony today that you evaluate your programs as they go along. The child care program started, I think, under the Janklow administration when it was not Western Dakota Tech. I can't remember what it was. Western Dakota Tech? Anyway, and he had a child care program. And he actually terminated it because they couldn't make enough money on the outside world to teach instructors. because that's what the child care industry is, low paid. Now, that has went on for how long? And yet, and not just under your watch, sir, I mean, I'm not, it's not just you, it's every president prior to that has allowed that to happen. And to grow into this $100,000, $150,000 monster. Well, when we're talking about a target of only $365,000, that $150,000 becomes awful important, or $100,000, any way you want to look at it. So I would hope that we, you know, take a really good analysis and look at what we have within our programs and at least be honest enough to come forward and say, this is going to cost us in the future. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Well, as long as we're making some comments and talked about facilities, I don't have to reiterate, I've been in the legislature a lot of years. I think it's probably maybe the first or second year Board of Regents met in Aberdeen and was talking about the facilities that we were education in the non-traditional students in Sioux Falls in the facilities there. And I happened to be in Sioux Falls, or they had a meeting there, and it was just how it all took place. And when they took us through some of them facilities where we was educating the non-trad students in Sioux Falls in the Center for Higher Ed or whatever we call it today or then, I would have been embarrassed to you know, have my daughter or son have to travel in some of the places that they went to school and had to park and walk to the classrooms and the quality of the classroom. It's kind of interesting. I said to them, well, why don't we utilize the facilities at Southeast Votech? They said they couldn't do that at that time. A couple of years later, they did it. But, I mean, it was just interesting. And now look what it's grown into, but the Center for Higher Ed in Sioux Falls. But that's 18 years ago, too. Just thought as long as we could comments about facilities, it was very disheartening for me to see some of the facilities those kids were going to classes in.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, one key thing, Dr. Bailey did bring this up. One of the key things is I think that is very important is we've made some key changes. Was not a whole lot of changes, but we've really zeroed in on how do we approve programs. How do we continue programs? And then we're looking at facilities and then overall looking at our strategic plan and coming up with some key goals. And this has probably been one of the most rewarding jobs I've ever been in. And I have four great leaders, four great school districts to work with. And a couple months ago, you noticed, if you watch the headlines, that two of our technical institutes were in the top 10% of graduates and being placed in high-paying occupations. Now, there was a stipulation in that, is that only 50% of your two-year community colleges could be recognized. We truly believe that if that was taken out of there, all four of our technical institutes would have been recognized. And Dr. Bailey brought up Western Dakota Tech's placement rate. That is unbelievable how much of an increase they have really cleaned up and got things done out at Western Dakota Tech. So kudos to our presidents at our technical institutes. Thank you.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Bailey, early in your presentation, you made the comment that you were getting some kickback from the industry in your vicinity. Can you expound upon that a little bit? What specific disciplines and what kind of industry and what programs you're getting the kickback from?
Let me explain why I said that. Our Western Dakota Tech Foundation just had a one of their larger quarterly meetings here in this past week, the foundation for the school. And the foundation is made up of, I believe, 18 or 19 kind of important community members within the Black Hills. Many of them are successful retirees, very giving people, both of their time and of their dollars. And they're in a position in life where they can really say what they think. And they're telling me what they think. Because some of them, one of them personally wrote a $50,000 check. This was for a 2 years, $25,000 a year to help us with some of the outfitting of the building and the other operating of our Western Dakota Technical Institute Foundation. So this person was not shy. And in a group of 17, 18 business people, primarily business owners and other VIPs of the community, they're in a position where they're giving their own time and their own money to this school. And seeing, in, again, this is my opinion of what I'm sensing out of this individuals, this group of individuals, that you know, it's difficult for them to give their time, their money, and continuing to see what they think is a very worthy institution that they're investing in continue to struggle so mightily with dollars. So I'm going to say it's more general than specific industries as far as that goes. I talk about our machinist industry, the gun manufacturers in particularly Sturgis and the near northern hills. They have a lot of fairly new young companies that are growing, a lot of new CNC equipment that they have purchased. Each of them, I would say about six of them in my meetings with them, said they each would like to hire one or two machinists over the next year. Well, that's pretty quickly now coming to the point where there's enough justified demand for us to reinstate the program. Keep in mind, we already have all of this equipment. We had a program sometime in about 2003 or 4, somewhere in there. There was not enough demand, not enough industry, no demand for machinists, so we killed the program. But we kept all the equipment. Right? So it's basically a large warehouse of equipment and modified it as part of kind of a hybrid with our welding program and called it a welding manufacturing program so that it allows people to have the opportunity to be able to not just do welding but go over to a Bridgeport milling machine or a Clausing lathe and machine that part back to whatever a serviceable position or point. So we believe that we're going to have, as that demand continues, more of a need for a machinist program. Unfortunately, I don't really have the equipment that they need me to train on. So now we're going to have to go into their shop, and we'll do that. We'll do whatever it takes. We'll go into their shops. We'll work with these employers because they're also desperate. They're trying to find skilled machinists. That's not an easy thing to do in western South Dakota. We don't really have a lot of critical mass. We don't even have a machinist program right now, a pure machinist program. I'm a graduate of Anoka Votech Institute's machinist program from Anoka, Minnesota. So it's very near and dear to my heart, this group of gun manufacturers and other machinist employing companies, such as hopefully Caterpillar and some of the others as we continue to get some critical mass there in western South Dakota. So we do expect that we're going to need to invest in the things that our industries need us to invest in, and we're always a little bit behind the eight ball. Unless we can find somebody that would just come in and say, here's a state-of-the-art piece of equipment, and when we can have that, you're never going to see me bringing that forward as part of an annual expense budget. There's just not the room in our dollars to do that. We'll have the employees, but not necessarily all the state-of-the-art equipment. We get that. We understand that. I'm not really trying to complain about that. But it is a demand always on us to be able to have the right equipment to train the right employees in the right at the right time.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going to kind of go more generalistic. Out of the four institutes, only one made actual cuts to salary instead of just cutting FTEs. Is that correct? So nobody else is having wage problems other than... Okay. I just wanted to make sure we were fully under the same page there on that. That it's just one trouble institution that I'm going to have issues with. Okay.
Senator Avery?
It's up. No, I was actually following
okay. Are there any other questions? We're going to take a 15-minute recess. And I would ask the presidents to please stick around in case there's some things that we'd like to call you back to the table for after we've had a brief break in the action. Thank you.
I like that break.
we'll come out of recess and get started. I believe that there were some questions that some of the committee members had for some of the presidents of the vocational schools. Senator.
Let's see. I have to get organized. I have to switch gears again. Just kind of want to go back and do a recap a little bit as far as all four institutes. And we got a nice handout here from Southeast Tech as far as detailing out. One of the comments that I heard over the break was it was very difficult to ascertain the different cuts and the different in a grid form. We pulled it out, we wrote it all down, but it would be really nice if we could get from all four institutes. And Jeff, if Mr. Holcomb, if you can help them prepare something similar to what you did. And you also had a nice written summary as well behind. If you could kind of give them your template, so then we have something consistent from all four technical institutes as far as all of the different cuts, that would be very helpful when it comes to kind of laying it all out. We get a lot of phone calls, and it's nice to have consistent data presented for us to be able to answer questions. And then just one other wrap-up thing as well. When it comes to, I'm sure we asked for the data. Now, Senator Haverly, did you have the, we asked for specific data on the budget or on this? On this. Did you write down what we had requested, Mark, on? Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So then those are just the two things to follow up on, and if we can make a note of that for the next meeting, to have those two pieces of information, that would be great. Mr. Chair, I think we only need one or two. Okay. If you could provide them to Tim, and then he'll disseminate it to the committee.
Any other questions or concerns that you'd like to address the four presidents of the vocational schools with?
Mr. Chair, I have one question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question or concern I guess I have is if we could also be kept in the loop as far as your negotiations with the Department of Labor. And then if there's anything else that we can do from the legislative standpoint to help in those negotiations. Obviously, we're the ones that put you in the predicament. We're the ones, as a legislative body, approved a budget that put you in the position that is creating the discrepancy between your bargaining unit and your facility. So if there's something we can do to help, keep us in the loop, too, and provide that to Tim and the committee, and they'll disseminate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question of Deb or Senator Peters. Deb, do you know, if I might, Mr. Chair, thank you. Do you know in any other bargaining issue in past there has been, this has been done in schools, I would think. Has there been any history or template that we could look at, you know, on the cost share, change of share? I was just curious. Maybe Representative Dryden could answer that as well as anybody.
I don't think so.
Okay. Just curious if there'd been any.
As far as I know, I have not heard of anything of this at this point, as far as when it comes to the tech schools being involved in these types of agreements and how it's affecting their budget. I don't think we've ever had a cut to this magnitude in ever. Well, since within at least the last 10 years. And so it's unprecedented that we are going down this route.
Well, I agree we haven't had a cut, but there's been teacher negotiations or impasses before in school districts, I would think. But
Mr. Chair, my understanding of the Sioux Falls School District, when they created their contracts, was about 10 years ago, prior to Jeff Holcomb and prior to Dr. Holman with the Sioux Falls School District, they had five-year contracts, and the five-year contracts included salary increases on a as enrollment increased or as state aid increased, the salaries increased at the same proportion. Within the last couple of years, things have kind of changed, and they've gone away from the five-year contract with already built-in increases, and they've gone to more of an annual negotiation. So the wording in the contract is the same, but the benefit package and the salary package is renegotiated on an annual basis, and that's a relatively new thing. And so as far as historical trends, we've never argued over money before because there's always kind of been money, I hate to say it, and this is the first year in the last 10 years there hasn't been the money there that has been there in the past.
Thank you. The reason I asked the question, though, is because I've read in the paper where schools and teachers have negotiated their salary package and got to them points. So I don't know if there's any boilerplate satisfaction in the end. But thank
you. Go ahead.
As far as the way I understand it also is Sioux Falls is a little bit more unique. They have bargaining units and a lot of different bargaining units. When it comes to negotiations of salaries and benefits, whereas other schools don't really have quite of an organized bargaining unit when it comes to salaries, is my understanding. So teachers are negotiating their contracts, but not to the extent to the numbers of the Sioux Falls School District due to the size of the school district. But Rapid City might have a different experience.
Any other things come before the committee today? Well, I'd like to thank the presidents for coming in, for their time and their diligence today to accommodate this hearing. And we're looking forward to working with you over the course of next year. Thank you. With that, we have a conference call that's going to go into the Corps of Engineers at about 4:05. That has been preset, so we'll stand in a recess until about 4:05, and at that point in time, we're going to the essence of time. The Corps also has a conference call that they need to make later on in the afternoon to accommodate everybody. We're going to just take testimony from the Corps of Engineers and questions from the committee. We're not going to take outside testimony, and we're not going to take outside questions. It should all be done on a conference call. Thank you. We're on the internet. We're live again. On the conference call, we have Jody Farhat with us. And in doing so, we're going, as I announced earlier, we're only going to take testimony from the court. Of engineers and questions from our government operations and audit committee. We're not going to open it up at this point in time to the audience or to the general public. Would you like to go ahead, Dana? I guess that we've got a couple questions that we'd like to have addressed or concerns. One of the concerns, I don't know where you want to start at, ma'am. But one of the concerns that I would like is that we get a little bit of an overview of leading up to the opening of the spillways at the dam and what we foresee in the future. And I understand that we all understand that the future is something, but if it's, everything goes as is planned right now, where we stand at. Is that possible?
Yes, sir. I guess I'll just kind of give you the background on how we got to where we are today. Basically, as you know, 2010 was a very high runoff year in the Missouri River Basin. We evacuated flood water during the late summer and fall and had higher than normal releases even during the winter period to ensure that we would evacuate all of the 2010 flood water prior to the start of this year's runoff season. And this is operating the manual in accordance, or operating the reservoir system in accordance with the master manual. What the master manual says is that at the start of each runoff season, we need to have the full flood control capacity of the reservoir system available. I know there is some confusion about that flood control storage, and I want to assure you that the amount of flood control storage in the main system is the same as it always is, 16.3 million square feet since the inception of the Mainstream Reservoir System. So on January 28th, we reached that level. We had the full flood control capacity of the reservoir system available, and we were well positioned for runoff events this year. My office monitors the snowpack during the winter, both on the plains and in the mountains. We were well aware of the above-normal plain snowpack. We were well positioned to handle that. And the mountain snowpack, all through the winter period, tracked around 110 to 115% of normal, right up until about the third week in April. So if you go back and look at our forecast that we put out on the 1st of April and the 1st of May, and accounting for all that snowpack, we showed that 2011 would be an abundant water year, but certainly we would not have record releases from any of the dams. Then really the game changer was that very heavy rain that fell over, particularly over the eastern half of Montana during May. The first weekend, or the second weekend in May, the 14th, 15th, that weekend we had a pretty extensive area getting a couple inches of rain. It was followed the next weekend by a wide area that got 5 to 8 inches of rain, and then additional rain the following week. So if you go to the National Weather Service, you'll see that that was the wettest May on record in the eastern part of Montana. And some of this rain also fell in western South Dakota, western North Dakota, northern Wyoming. And basically that rainfall runoff came into the reservoir system, filled up the reservoirs to a great extent, and took away the flexibility that we needed to break the reservoirs. During the month of May, we had the wettest or the highest runoff on record, 10.5 million acre feet of runoff during the month of May into the reservoir system. The previous record was 7.2 million acre feet. So this May was more than 1.5 times the previous record. And the other important thing about that is it did not include any snowmelt run. We lost very little snow during the month of May. On June 1st, most of the snow was still sitting there. So with that snow still sitting there and the reservoir now nearly full, the only option we have is to increase the releases out of the reservoirs. And so that's what we've been doing. As you know, dams and reservoirs, you know, cannot prevent all flooding. What they do is they allow you to capture the water and release it in a controlled manner. So, you know, despite these incredible releases that we're having, the Mainstream Reservoir System is operating as designed. We were able to hold the releases at around the 85,000 level out of Garrison and Oahe in time for the communities downstream to get their protective measures in place, and then we've been stepping up the releases since that time. We have to evacuate this water at this rate. All of the releases are controlled. We're using the spillways at all of the projects except for Oahe. We were a little careful about having to use that spillway at Oahe. It doesn't pose a dam safety risk, but it has an earthen channel below the spillway, and we know that there'll be extensive damage in that channel if we would have to use that spillway. So we're trying not to use that channel. These high releases are going to continue probably well into August, looking at our latest inflow forecast. And our goal is to get this water evacuated as quickly and as safely as we can. There's going to be a lot of work to do to clean up. We need to get the releases down. We need to go in and inspect and repair both in the river reaches between and below the reservoirs and also at our projects. We've had a lot of erosion around some of the outlet works, and we're going to have a lot of work to do this fall and over the winter to be prepared for next year. And that's the big unknown, whether or not 2012 will be, another high water year. So it's important to get this water out and do all the repairs that need to be done so that we're ready for whatever 2012 brings.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point in time? Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, and you may have actually said this once or twice, but the speaker system here, I'm having a hard time piecing a lot of it together. But was there a higher rate of release in comparison to years previous in anticipation for this? In other words, you had mentioned earlier, and I did catch this, that there was record rainfalls. And if you could you maybe tell me what the normal CFS release rate is and then what it maybe in comparison to that would have been this year?
I guess, what the point I guess I was trying to make when I talked about the higher releases is that was last summer and fall and over the winter period. We had those higher releases in order to evacuate the main stem system to be prepared for this year. But up until the May timeframe, until we saw that mountain snowpack go from, 110 to 115 and 115% of normal up into the 135 to 140% of normal, we were thinking that releases this year would be just slightly above normal. By the time we ran our May forecast, we had showed peak releases, say, out of Oahe in the 50,000 range, 50 to 55,000. That's probably about 20,000 more than we would normally see generally in the summer. Well, maybe not even that much. So slightly higher than what we would have expected this year if we were having a more normal year. But still well within, historic range.
I'm going to ask one question, Senator. What did you say the normal outflow would have been in a normal year? I didn't get that number.
Okay, let me grab a different report. One second, please.
Take your time.
Okay, in our annual operating plan that we put out last fall, under the median runoff condition, which is, if we have just a normal runoff year, we would have releases from Oahe ranging from the mid-20s to the low 30,000 range.
Thank you very much. Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much cubic feet per second is estimated to be coming into the Fort Peck in Montana at the peak?
The peak inflows that occurred this year?
What was the question?
Yes.
Or the current one?
This year.
Okay. I can pull that up on my computer if you can give me one second. I don't have that number right off the top of my head. Okay, it looks like the peak inflow that we saw into Fort Peck was 101,000 cubic feet per second on the 8th of June.
Thank you.
Yeah, but what is it today?
Representative Trevor Bell.
Ma'am, do you anticipate bringing the flow down at any time in the next week or 10 days?
You know, we had some very heavy rains up in South Dakota, as you know, overnight last night, and we did make a small adjustment in releases today, a temporary reduction from 160,000 down to 150,000, just because we had all this local rain in the pier area and also a lot of water coming into the Bad River, which was going to increase the level of Big Bend Dam pretty significantly. So we did make a short-term release reduction, just 10,000 CFS, and we plan to hold that for a day or two and then step the release back up and then remain on that higher level out of Oahu.
Thank you.
Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, I'm sure I caught it unless I didn't get the date just right, but I think you indicated that, I think it was around January 28th, and I don't know if that date's right, that you had the Oahu Reservoir level at the point that you wanted it for to handle the flood waters this spring?
Yes. The date is right, January 28th, and we had the full flood control capacity of the system available. As you know, during the winter, we have a difficult time making release adjustments because of the ice in the river. And so Oahu itself was a little bit lower than the desired level, and Garrison was a little bit higher just because we hadn't been able to increase Garrison's release because of the ice in the river this winter. But for the system overall, because it's operated as a system, we were exactly where we needed to be on the 28th of February, or 28th of January, I'm sorry.
Well, if I might, Mr. Chair. Thank you, ma'am. The reason I brought that up is I've, you know, caught some news skits in South Dakota, I guess, that saying that needs certain elevation to handle the floodwaters, and they was questioning whether it was within that range. But thank you for the answer.
You're welcome, sir.
Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through when the releases started to happen with the above normal precipitation through the Fort Peck and then also then down the river. Can you walk us through when you started to do the release, the water releases of higher than average? And then at what point were the towns notified all the way down the river? And I just am curious about all the different dams and then how each of the cities were contacted.
Okay. Well, you know, we've tried very hard during this event to ensure that state and local officials and your congressional folks are notified as soon as we make any release decisions. You know, there's sometimes a couple hours lag, but generally no more than that. You know, we want folks to be prepared for this flood event. So, I can tell you that week after the very heavy rains in Montana, so starting on the 23rd or 24th of May, we were in contact with the state and letting them know that the releases were going to be increased. Late in that week, we got forecasted for additional heavy precipitation, and so it was that Friday night and the May 27th and Saturday morning, May 28th, that the release, the decision to go to the 150,000 release was made. So we've been holding regular calls with what we call our CODEL group, our congressional delegation group, and I believe the states and local governments are always included on those, and the state emergency management folks. I don't work in emergency management, so I'm not, I don't handle most of those calls, but I know Colonel Rook has been in very close coordination with the congressionals and also with the governor and letting them know as soon as possible when we make a release change. So really, we're talking about late May is the time when we started making significant release adjustments. starting at Fort Peck. During that period, we actually reduced Fort Peck's releases because we had these very high inflows coming down the Yellowstone River into Garrison Dam. So we reduced from 20,000 release down to 10,000 release and then stepped that up in the early part of June, reaching 60,000 on the 10th of June and then 65,000 on the 12th of June. At Garrison, our coordination with state and North Dakota actually started much earlier than that, around the middle of May, when we saw the snow coming up and we talked to them. They were concerned about releases in the 45 to 50,000 range, so they had started setting up daily conference calls with us so that they could get the latest information. And then starting there, that right after that rainfall in that third weekend in May, we increased releases. We stepped up to 85,000 CFS. We reached that level near the end of May and held it for a couple days, and then gradually stepped up, and we reached the 150,000 release on the 17th of May. The reason the releases from Garrison were somewhat lagged was to provide an opportunity to get some water moving out of Oahe. Oahe at this time was very high, and since we were calling for the same releases out of the lower five dams, we wanted to first get a little water out of Oahe. So Oahe's releases were stepped up to 85,000. Looks like on about the 28th of May. These dates could be off a day or two. I'm just basing it on the date I have before me. Held at that level or near that level until early June, and then stepped up and reached 150,000 on the 7th of June. Big Bend was essentially on the same schedule as Oahe. The releases from Oahe are generally just passed right through Big Bend. It's a very small storage project with no significant flood control. Down at Fort Randall and Gavin's Point, our peak releases were a little bit slower in coming. We reached about 143,000 on the 14th of June and 150,000 out of Gavin's Point also on the 14th of June. So, the releases were gradually stepped up, over the period from late May until mid-June in general.
Follow-up, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a follow-up. When it comes to the notification, when you start releasing out of the Fort Peck and also then the Garrison, at what point do you start? When do people get notified? What is the policy? And again, I don't even live near the river, so I'm unfamiliar. So can you kind of walk me through what the policy is on notifications and who gets notified? When you're starting with the North Dakota folks, at what point do you start notifying South Dakota? And then at what point do you go into Iowa and Nebraska and downriver a little bit more? Can you kind of walk us through the policies that you guys have used in the past?
We're committed to providing, the best, most up-to-date information to everyone as soon as we can. We started having what we call those CODEL calls in late May so that we could notify all the congressional delegations throughout the basin from Montana all the way down to Missouri, and we want to do that at the same time so that folks all get the same information. The folks up at North Dakota, they were concerned and had asked us to do this coordination with them in advance of even knowing we were going to these very high flows. They were concerned with releases even in the 60,000 range, or 55,000 range. So that's why we had started coordinating with them. It was, the local operations managers talking with the state engineer and them requesting the additional coordination. And I know Eric Stosch, the OPM at Oahe, had also been in contact with the state folks and the cities of Pierre and Fort Pierre and had been talking to them. We had offered to do similar calls like we were doing with North Dakota, with South Dakota, but I think instead they said their having Eric available for their EOC was sufficient and they didn't need to do those daily calls. So I wouldn't say there's a strict, we don't have a written policy on at what point we begin coordination, but certainly anytime we have releases that are beyond what we would consider the normal range, we talk to the states and let them know so that they're well prepared and they can prepare their citizens.
Senator Haberle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, am not familiar with, I don't live on the river as well, so this is new to me as well. But in talking to folks around here, one of the concerns is about the, I guess it would be called the emergency or the spillway. What would create a situation to where you would have to release water from the spillway itself in opening the gates? And I drove up there and took a look at it this morning, and while the Hawaii seems relatively full, it also seemed like the water was approaching near the top of those gates. And so what would be the driving force to have to release water via the gates? And would you maintain a certain level of release, such as 160 combined, or would you have to split it up? And could you go more than the 160 CFS?
Right. First, let me start by saying our maximum release that we can get out of Oahu Dam using the outlet tunnels, or the regulating tunnels they're called sometimes, plus the power plant, is approximately 167,000 CFS. So one thing that would cause us to use the spillway at Oahu is if we needed to release more than 167,000 CFS, and at this time we don't anticipate that. So that would be the first reason we would open the spillway gates. What we would likely do if we had to go above 167 is we would maintain maximum releases out of the power plant and the outlet tunnels in order to release as small of a release out of the spillway as possible, because certainly, the more flow we put down that channel, the more erosion there will be in that earthen channel. And so minimizing those flows to the extent possible would be the prudent thing to do. The other thing that could cause us to use the spillway at Oahu would be if the reservoir itself would rise above elevation 1620. Now, elevation 1620 is the elevation of the top of the spillway gates when they're in the closed position. So what you saw up there today, the top of the gates is 1620, and you're right, we're very close to the top of those gates. We have about a foot of freeboard right now, which is certainly not as much as we wish we had, but we are where we are. So those would be the two circumstances that would cause us to open that spillway. And it's the pool or needing higher than 167,000 release.
Follow up, Hilbert.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, two questions come out of that one then, out of that answer, and I appreciate the answer, and that is sort of what I was thinking. But by reducing the amount of flow currently down to 150 CFS, aren't you running the chance of increasing the rate into the reservoir, thus pushing over the top and then having to control the water coming out of the spillway? Does that make sense?
Yeah. The release reduction we made today certainly will hold a little bit more water in Oahu Reservoir, although not very much. At this pool elevation, let me look here. We have there's more than 300,000 acre-feet per foot of storage. So if we cut back releases from Oahu, say, for 2 days because of this increase in flows downstream, you know, that will add less than a tenth of a foot. Actually, let's see, at Oahu, well, it's about a little less than 300,000 acre feet per foot. And just to give you my quick math, 10,000 CFS for a day, you double that number, so that's 20,000 acre feet. And so for 2 days, it would be 40,000 acre feet. So that would put maybe a tenth or two-tenths probably into Oahe. So, you know, we've taken that into consideration, and that's why when I talked about this release reduction at Oahe, I said it was a very short term. If we see the Bad River drop off tomorrow morning, we will return those releases at Oahe to 160 just as soon as we possibly can.
Another follow-up, Senator. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the last follow-up on that particular topic would be, and if you got to that point where you had to use the spillway, what type of a notification would you anticipate for the citizens or for at least the state at that point? I mean, it seems like everything is controlled, but yet there, you know, there's always those unknown factors like, you know, 3 or 4 inches of rain falling, and then 7 inches of rain falling upstream. So, what kind of notification would you anticipate if you had to use the emergency spillway?
You know, it would kind of depend on the situation. You know, if it's related to the reservoir coming up, it would be possible that we could use the emergency spillway and not even increase the total combined releases. We could, you know, let's say the reservoir came up and we decided to open all the spillway gates, you know, some small amount to pass a little water. Opening the spillway gates actually allows the reservoir to hold more water because as you raise the gates, you can essentially raise the top of the reservoir. So you get a little bit of storage if you use the gates. So I can imagine a scenario where we raise the spillway gates a little bit because we're trying to manage the reservoir and we actually reduce releases out of the power plant or the outlet tunnels and maintain the same releases. So, you know, in that case, it may not change the peak flows down through pier. We would certainly want to provide as much notice as possible because we, you know, I know folks would be concerned that we are using the spillway. If we, you know, we will always try to provide the most notification to the state as possible. We certainly don't want folks to be caught off guard. So, you know, we're working closely with the state EOCs, and I know Colonel Rook called the governor this morning and told him that we were making this release adjustment out of Oahe. You know, so we're trying to keep folks as up to date on the information as humanly possible.
Representative Dunkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, with you up in the flow out of Hawaii to one, you know, you've cut it to 150 now, but you were up at 160. What effect does that have on the system downstream, and can those dams match that, or is there going to be a rise in some of the reservoir systems below Hawaii?
What I can tell you is that, you know, our plan was to increase releases out of Oahe and Fort Randall and move some water from Oahe down. I'm sorry, we were going to increase releases out of Oahe and Big Bend and essentially transfer some water from Oahe down into Fort Randall Dam, which still had a fair amount of storage available. With this additional rain that fell last night, we're still analyzing the potential inflows and the impacts that will have on our releases. And I can tell you that that we're really running out of room everywhere, and it's quite likely that additional release adjustments on the lower dams will be necessary in order to manage these very high inflows that occurred out of from the rain last night. And, you know, I'm not talking about a huge increase in releases, but potentially, you know, a small adjustment in those releases because we're simply running out of room. We've been on this razor's edge for a couple weeks, and that rain that fell last night is exactly the sort of storm that can push us over the edge here.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that. Yeah, because I'd heard a rumor that the above Fort Randall was going to rise 4 feet in a short order here. That was just a rumor, and I appreciate your information. What would you – I know this is a moving target with the moisture and what's happening with the snowmelt. Below Gavin's Point, you know, where 150, I believe, is what you're stated right now, would you ever, with that being the lowest dam on the system, would you – you can't ever say never in with dealing with Mother Nature, but would you hopefully never have to go over the 150,000 at Gavin's Point?
Actually, I think with this latest round of rain, a release above 150 is quite possible at this time. You know, we're watching the inflows, and you know, we may have to make a small adjustment there, like we have made at Oahe. You know, up to the 155 to 160 range potentially.
Senator Hunoff.
Thank you. In your opening comments, you talked about Reading for 2012. I'm from Yankton, and so, you know, certainly see a lot of erosion that is occurring. In fact, one of the islands that was in the below the dam is not, just about non-existent. So is being proactive, what do you see that's going to need to be done with all this erosion that's happening down there as we prepare if we have a similar scenario in 2012?
You know, the river is going to be greatly changed below Gavin's Point Dam when we reduce these releases. We know that these high releases will scour the riverbed in some areas, and that sediment will end up deposited somewhere else, and certainly we'll have bank erosion in that reach between Gavin's Point and down to Omaha, where Omaha is kind of where the levees begin. So a lot of, you know, issues upstream there. And then downstream of, like, the Omaha Council Bluffs area is where all the levees begin, and they go pretty much to the mouth. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that all those levees will be impacted by this long-duration high flows, and many of those levee systems will need extensive repairs before next year. So I know that's not such an issue for the South Dakota folks, but it certainly will be an issue downstream. And you know, we'll have some work to do at each of our projects to make sure that the outlet tunnels, we get the riprap put back in to prevent any additional erosion and go in and inspect the facilities. You know, many of these, like the spillway at Big Bend and the spillway at Garrison, had never been used before, so you know, we need to go in once the flows come down and inspect and see if there's any repairs that we need to make.
Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of, I want to look a little bit more beyond today's current emergency. Kind of help us, walk us through what the process is going to be on maybe cleanup, or do we clean up the emergency levee system that has been put in place throughout the entire state of South Dakota? What is our next step when it comes to what do we tell homeowners with questions and concerns? Have you guys even started looking at that, and what can we start telling other folks?
Well, what we would like to do is to run these high releases long enough to get the reservoirs down so that we can have more normal releases, say, in the fall months. That would give time for folks to get in and clean up. What I can tell you in terms of the reservoir operation is that we will evacuate all of this water before the start of next year's runoff season. We will have 100% of the flood control storage available. And, you know, we went through that long master manual review process from 1989 to 2004, and we looked at more than a 100-year period of record. Our records go back to 1898, And that 16.3 million acre feet of flood control storage that is provided for in the mainstem reservoir system was sufficient to handle all of those years of record. So from 1898 to 2010, that 16 million acre feet of storage was sufficient. The only year that it hasn't been sufficient were the releases themselves were at a high enough level to cause damage was 2011. So I guess what I would tell someone is, you know, to rest assured that the system will be ready for next year, and that, you know, barring another year like this, which is, you know, is a record runoff year in many ways, we'll have more than twice our normal record. It's going to be more than 10%, probably 15 or 20% higher than the previous record year. You know, I would say that, you know, we'll be well positioned to handle whatever next year comes. But it's just important to get this water evacuated so that we'll be ready.
Senator Haverly. I'm sorry, go ahead to follow-ups.
Thank you. I'm not necessarily a follow-up, but I just wanted to extend a thank you, and I'm sure you'll hear it more than once up here from us. But just want you to know and thank you for your service and let you know that we're here to help. If there's anything else you can do, if anything we need to do to help you out, to help the message get out, obviously there's a bunch of us in the room today, so just let us know.
Thank you very much.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to jump back just briefly onto the spillway. Has the spillway for Hawaii ever been used, or I don't know if do you test those or?
It has never been used to release water. We do, as part of our regular dam safety schedule, we do periodic inspections and annual inspections of the reservoirs. And during those inspections, we operate the spillway gates to ensure that they function.
Okay.
While we do those inspections, we would, unless the water wasn't up in the spillway channel there, but we would insert stop logs upstream of the gate so that we could exercise the gate. So, you know, we're certain that the spillway gate and that the spillway structure itself will operate as designed, and we're confident on that. And really the driving factor for not using it is to avoid that huge repair bill that will be associated due to the erosion that we'll get down that channel. We are fully ready to operate it if we have to. I know there was a railroad embankment or some other structure on the lower end of that. And we've removed that, and we're ready to go if Mother Nature takes us that way.
Follow-up, Senator?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I've been told, because I wasn't up in this area in 1997, but during that flood, the Corps came in after the flooding and essentially was mandating what elevation housing had to be at in order to not run into this situation again. Somebody I think told me it was 14.2 or 14.3, something of that nature. Do you foresee that number, of course, no longer being relevant in several cases? Do you see that same type of an environment post-flood here where houses have to be elevated to a certain level that are near the flooding area? And no building allowed in certain areas unless they obtain that? I sort of caught bits and pieces of your answer before, so you may have already answered that.
Yeah, actually that's not a function of the Corps of Engineers. I think that's more of a FEMA issue and part of the flood insurance program that your communities may participate in. The Corps plays a minor role in that, in providing potential inundation levels at various types of events. I think they generally look at 100-year flood elevation, and so we provide FEMA with that information. But the actual flood information or floodplain zoning, it goes through FEMA, and then it's more of a state or local issue. And the Corps of Engineers' role in that is very limited.
Well, thank you very much for taking part. Senator Haverly's got a wrap-up.
Yes, and again, and you've, as you've already heard, thank you very much for coming before the committee and allowing us an opportunity to sort of get some answers to some questions that we're anticipating from some of the citizens of South Dakota. And again, if it hasn't been said before, thank you for at least allowing it, and I wasn't here at the time, but allowing some timeline for folks and volunteers to come in and establish a wall of defense, if you will, against what they had to deal with. And for a guy that's from out of town and looking at what you folks do and look at what the folks, the citizens and volunteers did in this community, it's just, I'm in awe still, and I just got back into town last night. So thank you for that.
You're welcome, sir. And it's my pleasure to speak before you, and I'm always here. If you have additional questions, I'd be happy. You know, it's in both of our best interests to get the right information out to the public. And so anything that we can do to further that, please let us know.
I believe this has helped a great deal. And I think that it's always nice to get the information directly from where we need to be getting it. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. We will be probably talking to you in the future. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Is there anything else to come before the committee this afternoon? And we sit in recess till tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Thank you.